just radio. Nobody can see you. You don't.
K-N-I-K.
We named it after the old town of Pinnock. Don't you think that was a good choice?
I'll say, what frequency is it on?
105.5. This is FM. Do you have an FM radio yet, Bob?
Sure.
You sure should.
I've got one with about half a dozen bands on it. It must be.
It has to be an FM band there somewhere.
What hours is this on?
8 o'clock in the morning until midnight.
105 FM.
Yeah, you can. This tells you something about it, so.
FM band.
Mm-hmm.
How much power is there on it?
Gee, I don't know that, Bob. I thought maybe Tilly'd come along this morning. Maybe nobody extended the invitation.
Well,
that
I think
way.
We overlooked that.
That's her. I'll get her by herself then. So you can say anything you want about her now, and then she can say anything back at you that she wants to.
That's fair enough.
I think so too. Bob, this has just been a wonderful experience for me. This is the kind of thing I always love to do. You know, I interviewed you a number of years ago. But getting this down on tape, you know, and having an excuse to just keep going, and everybody refers to somebody else. Everybody will say, hey, you should talk to so-and-so, you know.
Got a good idea there, Ruth. Last winter, I did an extension.
Thank you, Peter. Yeah, Golden Earrings, a Victor Young tune. And now, back to the series that we have been so much enjoying of talking with the folks who made the history of this particular neck of the woods we call Alaska. And one man who wrote a good deal of its history himself across the sky is Bob Reeve. You can't tell the story of Alaska or of Anchorage without, sooner or later, running into that name, Bob. When did you come into the picture? What year?
Actually, I was in first time I was in Alaska was in 1921. In fact, June 21st, the longest day of the year.
Oh, you're a Johnny-come-lately then, aren't you?
Well, that's my new boy, yes, compared with the people from 98.
Yeah, fellas like Steve McCutcheon and some of the rest of those who came in the early 15, 16, 17, they sort of beat you.
I think they were born here, come to think of it.
Some of them were. Well, of course, you were kind of holding back until you could do some flying. You didn't want to travel up here the hard way. This dog team means was too slow for you.
Well, as a matter of fact, I was on a boat when I first came to Alaska, and it was in the Aleutians where I first set foot on Alaska soil. And then I returned in 32. I've been making a profession of flying for the last 6 or 7 years prior to that.
That was where, by the way, Bob?
Well, that was all over the States, and I flew in every country in South and Central America. And many people ask me why I came to Alaska on there. I will tell you the truth of that, Ruth, on there. I heard that the bush pilots laid in bed till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. On there before they went out and did fly, and I said, that's the life for me.
Somebody'd been kidding you, Bob. Did you find that to be true when you got up here?
Oh, no, a lot of them did a pretty good job at it.
You sure didn't.
Hell, no, and especially after I got married and started to raise a family on there. And then it was a case of laying in bed as long as I want, as long as I was up about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my goodness. You said that you first set foot on Alaskan soil in the Aleutians. There was something prophetic about that then, maybe.
Yes, it was. I came back as a workaway on a boat from Vladivostok. I'd spent a couple of years in the Orient prior to that, and I was on my way back to complete my education at the request of my father. See, I think I was 19 years old at that time.
And you'd already done all this traveling?
Oh, yes. I'd spent 2.5 years in the Army in World War I beside that.
I would think that what you saw out there in the Aleutians would have just made you want to go anywhere else in the world.
Now, Ruth, on there, what you see in the Aleutians on there in the area. The time I was there was a lot of fog, and I tell you, I didn't see very much.
That's what I mean.
On there, but there was a lot of the old sea otter hunters still around Little Alaska on there, which is right across the bay from Dutch Harbor, and I had a chance to visit with them, talk with them, and as a kid, I was used to trap a lot myself, and I became very greatly interested in the Aleutians, that aspect of it, that is. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize at that time that some 40 years later that I would be running an airline down there.
With the name Aleutians in it.
Yes.
Revolution Airways. Mm-hmm. Well, now that's getting ahead of our story. Okay, here you come back aboard ship, back to the United States. And your dad wanted you to go back to school, so did you and where?
Yes, I completed 3 years of high school in 6 months. And then I went on to the University of Wisconsin.
Goodness, that took some doing. Of course, you already knew all the geography.
Yes, geography was easy.
You'd learned that. What did you take at the university?
When they went to law school.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened to that?
Well, I actually, my college career was predicated on pleasing my father on there, who was determined that I would have a college education. I went to college merely, and I will tell you, completely and merely to please him. And when I got up, and at the first opportunity, I left college and I went into flying in 1925, which I'd always wanted to do.
Tell me about
some lessons early in 1920.
Tell me about your first flight, your first ride in a plane.
Oh, my first ride in an airplane was an old Jenny in Camp Custer, Michigan. On there, one of the World War I flyers or the early birds that get a few planes when they were out on the parade ground taking the soldiers up at $5 a crack, just up and around the field.
Were you in the Army at that time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was still in the infantry. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in the Air Force anymore. I was in the infantry in World War I.
And that's where you caught the fever to begin with?
Well, I was always a kind of an escapist, you might call it, and I still think I'm an escapist to a degree. If you know, a cowboy's an escapist. He makes a living here because he likes to ride, and the pilot in many respects is the same way. And I tell you, Ruth, oftentimes I get awful discouraged. This game would be a wonderful game, this flying game, if it weren't for the lost baggage.
Oh, Bob.
If it weren't for the baggage. Well, that's no
laughing
matter.
You would think of something like that.
That's no laughing matter. You get 60, 70 passengers on there, and you
multiply
lose their
by two or three.
They're on there, and it's really a problem. I've licked it to a considerable degree.
How?
Why, just writing her down every piece of lost baggage and finding out the culprit who had a part in losing it or leading it astray, and just letting them know that that if anybody loses a piece of baggage, they're going to see me swarm right down on them on there. And I'm not always a nice fellow that I would like to be out to be when it comes to that. I'll never forget the first flight we had with our DC-4 aircraft. We'd been flying threes and carrying 20, 25, 30 passengers in them. We got this new four-engine aircraft which hold up to 70 passengers. And we flew it around for about a month, getting it on our operating certificate. And overnight, I decided to put it on our regular schedule on there. We'd clean up all the passengers, but we had one passenger, so we sent it out on that plane. Here we have this 70-place airplane with one passenger. And now, what do you suppose happened, Ruth?
Now, don't tell me you lost one of his bags.
That's absolutely correct. We lost all his baggage. Lost his baggage.
Oh, dear. Well, now, wait just a minute. We've still got to back you up. All right. So, you had your first flight. You had your first ride in an airplane. Then where and how did you yourself learn to fly?
Oh, I learned to fly down in Texas amongst a bunch of barnstormers. I practically self-taught with an old Jenny. And then I went in the Army Air Corps. I barnstormed around there while I went in the Army Air Corps for a period. And then I went to work for several outfits in Arizona, flying in the Grand Canyon and down in northern Mexico. And then I went with the Ford Motor Company. They had just developed a three-engine metal, all-metal airplane, which they were grooming to use on all the scheduled air carriers. And I went through their school and learned all about the plane mechanically and how to fly it. And then I took five of them down to South America for Pan American Grace Airways. I worked for Pan American out of Miami and Havana and Belize and British Honduras and
Managua. You're not on that run now.
Managua. Well, more or less, yes. And then I went down when they opened up the direct mail route between Santiago, correction, Cristobal, and Santiago, Chile on there. I started that out for them in Pan American.
You flew some pretty rough routes in South America, like in the Andes Mountains area. Gave you some of your early experience in really rough weather and flying conditions, isn't that right?
That's correct, Ruth. The Andes is really a tough proposition flying due to the great height of the mountains and the winds At the time we were down there, there was no radio, no air nav aids or anything. And I regarded it as pretty tough until I came up to Alaska and saw some of our peaks around here and the winds and the lack of air nav aids and weather reporting and everything. And I really changed my mind that the flying down there had been really a pleasure compared to flying in Alaska.
Of course, it gave you a little experience that came in handy after you got started.
That's right. I got a lot of experience on there, which stood me in good stead.
Okay, now let's get you to Alaska. All this time you've been flying everywhere else, you hadn't forgotten this brief stay out there on the Aleutians. What really brought you back up to Alaska?
Well, actually, I told you previously on here that I'll tell you what happened, Ruth. I had a little wreck down there, and I smashed an airplane up, and the board of directors of Pan American Greece Airways were kind of stuffy about it. So I beat them to the draw, and I resigned and came up to Alaska, where I always had wanted to settle. I had no intentions of staying in South America for the remainder of my life or anything. I figured I'd get a stake and come up here and start my own airline. I always wanted to. And it was also, I had the thought that if I was going to get killed, I didn't want to get killed flying. I didn't want to get killed for old Pan Am or your old Pan Am. I was going to get killed flying for myself. At that time, we had a lot of attrition amongst the male pilots down there.
So this is
1932.
When you finally came back, ready to pick out a spot to fly. My goodness, Bob, what did you do? Pick the worst area in the whole country that you could find to start an airline?
Well, that is correct, more or less. I came up to Anchorage here and Seward, and there were other pilots here who had already had the country staked out. And while competition never bothered me, I went over to Valdez and saw that there was a modest future there, flying around the gold mines and the glaciers and serving them and everything, and so I settled there.
Mm-hmm. You know, the last time I was at Valdez, I had my mother and dad with me, and they had just finished reading Glacier Pilot. And they said, if we don't do anything else down here in Valdez, we want to go out and see where Bob Reeve landed on the grass. Now, is this really true?
Yes, Ruth. I'm flying over the Columbia Glacier on there. I'd seen a vein out through through a nunatak sticking out in the glacier on there. Nunatak is just a piece of rock on there, surrounded by ice, that's sticking out. And the only time I could get to it, I realized, was in the summer, and I couldn't take off when wheels landed there. Although later on I developed a technique of landing on wheels on the ice. So I experimented on the mud flats and found out that the goose grass on the flats was very slick and was a very efficient operation. In fact, in many respects, in spite of its muddiness, you call it, was far more efficient than using snow.
In other words, you had skis so that you could land on the glaciers.
Yes.
And you had to land back where there was no snow on these skis.
That's right. And take off, by the same token, take off and go up to the glacier too.
Well, we drove out there and we looked over those mud flats and we saw the grass and we still could hardly believe it. Actually, landing on the glaciers was also an extremely hazardous trip.
Yes, it was. You had to learn to keep out of the crevices and keep the willywas from smacking you down. There were many aspects of landing on glaciers on there which you couldn't exactly buy a book and learn on it.
You wrote the book, Bob.
You had to learn the immorality of the hard way, Ruth.
Tell me honest and true, would you go out and do that today?
Oh, sure, I wouldn't hesitate to do it all over again. Although, I'd quit a little sooner than I did, because on those glacier flights down there, I not only ran out of my own luck, but all my friends' luck, and about 10,000 other people's luck, Ruth, the years I spent landing on those glaciers.
Well, about the time you felt your luck was being strained, what was your next step?
Well, next step, I had a family, two kids. I had a boy and a new daughter on there, and the economic possibilities of Valdez are just about rung out, and it was a pretty tough making a living on there, so I decided to find another place to roost down there, so I decided to move to Fairbanks in the hopes that there were more flying around there or I'd be able to make a new start. And I did move to Fairbanks. I recall that flight. We had had Tilly and the boy and the daughter and my mother-in-law and the cat and my old Fairchild 71 and the washing machine in there and a few items and a few groceries we had left. And I also had $40 to pay down in the first month's rent in Fairbanks.
You were pretty well fixed.
Oh, I was a regular capitalist.
I should say so. Competition for old cap playthrough.
Yes.
How long did you stay in Fairbanks?
Stayed there for 2.5 years. Fortunately, that move I made up to Fairbanks was one of the best I ever did on there, because 6 months later, Hitler had been in the war about a year or 2 years, and our nation's leaders in Washington suddenly realized that we were going to be in the conflict too, and we better start getting prepared for it. And with this end in view, they built they started constructing a series of fields between Canada and the United States and all over Alaska to strategic points. And I was free at that time, and I had an airplane, and I got in. And one of the few people on there that were able to go and spend all their time on these charters. So I leased my aircraft out, and I spent for the next 8 months, I spent my total time on there flying with this line, with these, surveying and constructing these new airports. And that line, I remember, recall that at the Besna on there, I flew in 1,100 tons of materials in that field in there, in a field where they could not get in any other way. Mm. At that time, it was the biggest freight job ever attempted in the Pacific Northwest, in Alaska, and or Canada.
You weren't lying in bed till 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a job like that.
Oh, no, we were up at daybreak on there, and made a stake on there. I made a stake of about $40,000-$50,000 on there, and I'd been so broke all the years before that on there that I imagined myself with about $50 million on there. I just couldn't get used to the fact that I had a $50,000 stake. So I went out and I bought some more aircraft, and later on I moved to Anchorage. By that time we had the Pearl Harbor came, and I moved to Anchorage because I knew that with the war on and with the development of the flying here down the Aleutians, at Anchorage was eventually just destined to become the big air center of the Pacific Northwest. And for once in my life, I was right. And nowadays, as you well know, Ruth, here we have probably 220,000 people in Alaska. And where we're standing here in this studio, sitting here, we have about 115,000 people live within a 15-mile radius. 100% of them are engaged in transportation. Even the Air Force out here is transportation, because a rocket and a bomb are carried on wings and a whale, and the Army's transportation too, because the GI, he don't walk anymore, or you'd sure hear from his congressman about it. He rides in a weapons carrier or a tank or some other method of rapid transportation. And you know, with our, we have 6 air carriers making one stop, over the pole, over from Europe, over the pole here. Just with our new jets, we have 8 airlines operating in and out of here, not to mention the marriage of those God's noblemen, the new Bush pilot down there who bases here, and he flies all over.
This is still a tremendous part of the flying pattern of the Anchorage area, is the small plane.
Oh yes, very much so.
In fact, I wonder if you happen to have, the latest statistics as to where Anchorage stands with the rest of the United States in the amount of traffic in this area?
It's way up, way up.
There are very few communities that have more.
There's no other community in the United States that has any comparison with the ratio of aircraft per 100 population than Anchorage has.
Certainly true. Well, now let's get Revolution Airways started here. What year was the beginning of that?
Well, I started business as Reeve Airways, and then at the end of the war in 1946, there we got one of the blessings of the war, if you can ever say there is one, is the fact that a lot of new aircraft called the Douglas DC-3 that was named the C-47 by the Army Air Force. And they were put up, any veteran or anybody that had $2,500 down payment could buy one of those for $20,000 and be in business with his own airline. And dozens of veterans bought these aircraft Very few of them are still in business on there because the survival of the law and the fittest. However, I was very fortunate in this respect, because the first aircraft I got, there was a strike started between here and Seattle.
1946. I remember.
And there was no other motor transportation. And I geared all my operation, got ready for that. And then, as I recall, in 52 days, I put in 266 hours as a pilot and crew member, and we grossed $93,000, and I made enough to buy three more aircraft, and I ended up with four DC-3s, which is a converted C-47.
Mm-hmm. They were a wonderful workhorse, weren't they?
Yes, we still have two of them on there. They do a very fine job.
Mm-hmm. So, Reeve Airways is now launched.
Yes.
And how did you get out into the Aleutian?
Well, in the meantime, during the war, I had a contract the Army Signal Corps, and I've been flying all over the Aleutian doing their bush flying and their odds and ends for them that other pilots didn't want to do. And meanwhile, right after the war, I filed for a regular scheduled air route down the Aleutians. And I, in addition to flying on this Seattle route, as I said, we used to run every week down there, and I did gradually develop this route. There, over a period of years, I was certificated in 1948 on this route, and got a permanent certificate in 1953, 5 years later.
You didn't have much competition for that particular route, did you?
No, but after everybody, it's just as the Bible's got a word for it, it was ever thus. As soon as everybody saw that I was making a go of it, everybody wanted the route. Well, everybody wanted to get in the act. However, in my own way, I was able to take care of them on there, and they came back to the mainland on there, and then another less damaging lines of enterprise to my airline.
I remember an article in Reader's Digest a few years ago that was called "The Airline No the Air Route or Airline Nobody Wanted," and I picked up my Reader's Digest and I thought, well, that sounds like the Aleutians. And I flipped over a few pages, and here was a story about Bob Reeve.
That's correct. There is a very descriptive article too. It was written by Rhoda Harris, who was the wife of the sheep rancher at Mikulski, and the Aleutians on there. And our aircraft got in there for the first time in history. She was able to get her mail once a week or oftener or anything. Although there was no landing field at Mikulski at this place. We used to airdrop her mail there.
Mm-hmm. By parachute?
No. We had a bomber.
Just heaved it out.
We just went out after the war and cut some old bomber leases off some old B-24, B-17 bombers and put them on the bottom of our DC-3s and just tripped that mail, put a sack, a couple of 100 pounds of mail in, and just tripped it when it got over, and down it came.
Mm-hmm.
And hit the soft tundra on there, and we very, very rarely had any damage or loss.
And was your aim pretty accurate?
Oh, yes. Apparently, if they could get it day after day or week after week, that is, within a 10, 20, or 30 feet of where they wanted it.
Uh-huh. Well, now, what is the major portion of your traffic out to the Aleutians now? Is it the tourist? Is it the trapper? Is it the furs? What is the main proportion of it?
Well, we have a cross-section of everybody out there, Ruth. I would say that the, for instance, last year, I would say that 40% of our revenue derived from passengers. Correction, 60% from passengers, and the other 20% each by mail and freight.
Cargo.
And those passengers are a cross section of everything.
Mm-hmm.
They may be the people from ADAC, Navy at ADAC, the dependents, the kids, they may be contractors, they may be construction workers, they may be a postal inspector or a doctor going out, or people going up to the Pribilof Islands to process the fur seals once a year, or fishermen there, or halibut fishermen, or people taking movies, or very few tourists. It's just a normal cross-section of all travel, although we do carry very, very few people as sightseers down there.
Uh-uh.
For the main reason that the Far Aleutians are a restricted area under national defense.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, at Shemya now, we have one of the biggest listening posts under the American flag. They say that they can see a football being kicked up in Red China or Siberia. And it was through the Shemya installation there that we first had news of Gagarin, is that the first Soviet mm-hmm. space fellow on there? Saw him first, and we were alerted to this, and we were taking, the Soviets sent a lot of pre-runs of this rocket through the air, and it was all observed, and we did some, we were in on the act too, because we got some materials and took it up here and rushed it up here so it would get back to the president mm-hmm. before the original shot in space came into effect.
So it didn't come as any surprise,
This is not non-restricted because I've read the same thing in the New York mm-hmm. papers.
Mm-hmm. But very few tourists. Seems to me that this would be something that could be, if I may use the word, exploited, because here is a phenomenon that the ordinary person anywhere else in the world wouldn't be able to see, the fur seals, their breeding grounds, and so forth.
Yes, we have a modest tourist trip up to the Pribilof Islands, where they probably 2 million seals congregate once a year to rear their young and perpetuate the race up there. And on that island, they are, on the St. Paul Island, there live approximately 400 of the original Aleuts who were enslaved by the Russians mm-hmm. there and taken up there, and they still maintain bear the Russian names.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very far away, it's 1,000 miles away, and the weather, there's not too many accommodations, and the weather is never the best on there, and our carriage of these people in here is very limited.
For the
main reason that, two reasons, that it is very costly, costs $176 a trip, and also that not too many people are interested in just wildlife in itself.
I suppose so. And then, too, the time of the year is limited. What are the months when the seals are there?
In July and August.
I see.
These seals they leave there in the fall from October through December, and they go down in the Pacific Ocean, and they never come back to land until the next June, when their instinct brings them back up to the place they were reared in the Pribilof, that is St. George.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Paul, and the reason they come here is that because of the temperature, which hovers around 35, 40, 45 degrees, the moisture and the fog drifting in the air, and the rocks there have no soil, loose soil, mm-hmm. which will get in their fur
mm-hmm.
and damage it and render it such a condition that if they were out to sea, they would sink.
Mm-hmm.
So this, they come back here because it more perpetuates the 8-10 months they spend in the water, and otherwise they would die of hydration, dehydration.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other breeding grounds where the similar action takes place?
Yes, there's one over in Japan, and one in the Falkland Islands, and one near Siberia.
Mm-hmm. But it's still quite unusual. Of course, as you say, there are drawbacks, but maybe in the future, there are people, tourists, traveling, who are looking for the unusual, the out of the way, the something different to talk about when they go home. And it seems to me that this certainly fills all the qualifications they're seeking.
Yes, it is a fabulous trip.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few people that we take out there, which will run between 50 and 100 every year. There we get, they have never failed, each mm-hmm. one of them, to write a letter mm-hmm. of great appreciation of the fabulous things they have seen.
That's what I've heard.
Many other things they're seeing there beside the seals. Have exotic Arctic flora,
yes.
and there's sea lions, and dozens of different varieties of Arctic birds.
But there have been many feet of film used.
Yes, and blue foxes,
mm-hmm.
and reindeer. Yes, it is one of the greatest homes of wildlife in the world.
Well, Bob, we should have talked a little bit about Anchorage. Certainly, it's evident already that you have, as I said in the beginning, written a considerable chapter in the history of Anchorage. You saw the story of the aircraft from the time Merrill Field was the only landing field, and now we've already practically outgrown our new international airport. And you've mentioned, too, the number of planes flying through here. Surely the future of the Anchorage area, just as well as the past, is going to be closely tied to aviation, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Although we have a very extensive oil development around here, and we'll eventually have hydroelectric power down there, Anchorage will be the center of communications, finance, and transportation for this area.
Back up a little bit. Now, Anchorage became your home in the early 30s. Of course, you've mentioned the two oldest youngsters, your son. That's Bob Jr., isn't he?
No, Richard.
My son is the oldest one.
Oh, Dick.
Let's see, he's just about through college now, isn't he?
Well, he's graduated from college 2 years ago. He's now a co-pilot with us on there. Mm-hmm. He's 24, Roberta's 21. Janice is 18, Dave is 16, and Whittem is 14.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, were the last three born here in Anchorage then?
The last three born in Anchorage and the first two in Seward. Yes. We didn't have any hospital in Valdez. Yes,
that's right. And Richard certainly has laid the foundation for stepping into Dad's shoes.
Well, that's right. Ever since he was 10 years old, he's worked at the airlines and started sweeping up, and he's done everything on it from sweeping up to mechanics, to radio, to dispatching, to running stations, and flying. He has a very well-rounded knowledge of the airline business.
He's starting out a little better equipped than you were when you started in the airline business.
That's right.
Now, which one of your daughters is working as a stewardess for another airline?
That's Roberta. She's 21. She's been with the Flying Tigers. Roberta spent 2 years at the University of Alaska, but all her girls in her age group are getting married and wheeling the baby buggy around within a year or so on there. Roberta said, "This is not for me. I'm going to see the world first."
Good for her.
So after the end of her second year in college, she told me, says, "I'm going out with my own dad." I says, "Well, fine. What you gonna do?" I said, "Well, I'm gonna get a job with the Flying Tigers, fly all over the world," which she did.
She had any experience as a stewardess with you?
Oh yeah, she worked for us for 2 years, two seasons while she was in the summer, while she'd go on to school.
Good experience.
Oh yes, and she spent 6 months flying all over the Far East, Okinawa, Guam, Honolulu, Japan, and so forth, and for the last 5 months, she's been flying out of New York into Europe, and I think she's been in almost every country in Europe except Soviet Russia.
Another chip off the old block.
More or less, yes.
How about the rest of the youngsters? Are they as interested in flying as the first two?
Oh, yes. Janice is worked this summer as a stewardess, and also as extra help on our reservations out in the field. Dave who's 16, is a third year as a radio apprentice in our shop. Whittem is only 14. He's out. He just the law says he can't work until he gets around 15 or 16.
But he's just marking time till he can.
That's correct. They're all very talented. They're working with their hands and electronics.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Bob, do you yourself do any flying anymore?
Oh yes, but not of a commercial nature. I'm very happy to be an honorary member of the 317th Fighter Interceptor Squadron out here. Mm-hmm. At Elmendorf Air Force Base, and every now and then I go up with the Colonel Joe Rogers or some of the boys on there, and they let me fly around a little, but they never let me land or take off.
They won't?
No.
You mean they can't trust you with those planes?
Well, I think that they, I don't know the reason on there, except that the aircraft's worth about $500,000, maybe that's the reason.
Bob, it isn't any more valuable than your first planes were to you. You were, there was just as much riding on it at that time, I'm sure.
Well, that's right. That's right. In fact, my first aircraft, anything ever happened to it on there, it was like a world coming to an end.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful story. I mentioned the Reader's Digest article. I really should have referred also to the wonderful story, Glacier Pilot, which, of course, is the story of Bob Reeb. Anybody who hasn't read that had better hop to one of the bookstores, because this is a wonderful story. I remember, as I mentioned, my folks were here in the summer of 57, and we saw Valdez, and they particularly wanted to see where you had landed. And Bob, I think one of the real thrills was one afternoon they had come to town with me, and we had lunch at the Club 25. By the way, Myrtle Stalnecker and her sister are going to be my guests next week. And I happened to look up, and I said to Mom and Dad, well, there's Bob Reeve and his wife over there, and you folks had had lunch, and you were just leaving, and I stopped you and introduced them. And this, Bob, was one of the high spots of their visit to Alaska. They loved the story, which I had mailed to them. They had read it before they came back up here. They had loved the story, and to be able to meet you and your wife in person was just a real thrill to them.
Well, very kind of you say so, Ruth, but I want to correct that story on the Glacier Pilot. That isn't my book. That's everybody's book.
Well, yes, but it's about you, certainly. Written by, what was it, Jean?
Beth Day.
Day,
yes.
Uh-huh.
It's on the third edition now, too.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wonderfully written. That gal can write, but of course she had the material to write with. Understand she practically camped on your doorstep for several months getting that story out of you.
Yes, it was, I gave her the synopsis and the incidents, and then she correlated them later. But whoever, a lot of people who read that book, some of it's so fantastic on there that it's unbelievable on the things that have happened. And she spent another 4 months all going over Alaska verifying the text of the things that I told her, not only told her, but the other pilots had told her.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very, very authentic book.
In other words, she didn't just take it on your say-so. She checked every bit of it.
That is right.
But as you say, it's a lot of it is just unbelievable. And yet we assure you it's all true, just as this wonderful story that Bob Reeve has told us this morning. Well, I certainly do thank you, Bob. As I mentioned earlier, we should have made it clear that we'd like to have had Tilly this morning, but of course she wouldn't have been able to get a word in edgewise, or maybe it would have been the other way around.
She does a pretty good job, Ruth.
We'll get Tilly here all by herself so that neither one of you would have had any competition, because her story is, well, it parallels, of course, it's your story too, and they both go together, and I shall certainly look forward to having Tilly come and tell her side of the Reeve story. Thank you so much, Bob, for coming. I appreciated this.
Ruth, it's always a great pleasure to be on your programs, and thanks for including me.
Happy to have had you. Wouldn't have missed it. Now, Peter, if we may go back to Wayne King and his orchestra.
Righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Heine, I've really been looking forward to this. You know it's been an awfully long time since I've had a chance to talk with you.
Yeah, I was outside for 6 months, too.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the Tournament of Roses.
You did. Had you ever been to that before?
No. It was wonderful.
You're too lucky.
In San Diego and all over, and visited lots of friends. I was especially surprised to see in Santa Barbara they had an Alaskan club with 300 members.
Really? A former
Alaskan? All
Alaskans. Well, for goodness
sake. Railroad conductors and...
Mostly.
Retired people. And it's a wonderful climate and
mm-hmm.
nice people.
Mm-hmm. You aren't thinking of retiring down there.
Well, I might go out the winter from mm-hmm. now again. And I really like to go and make another trip. I like to make a trip through Africa. I've been there before, you see.
Yes. You started out as a sailor, didn't you?
Well, yes, a steward on the boats.
Is that what your job was?
And I think, and one time I shipped as a sailor. And I don't think there is very many left. And that was on a sailing ship at work. From South America on the Rio La Plata to Window, Russia, 86 days. And we lost three men overboard. We had a hurricane, what do you call it? And then I had my brother with me, and we separated, and he got on a German boat, and he was killed in gas, and he was in his room, and they accidentally closed him.
Oh, excuse me. Wait a minute. Here we go. Thank you, Peter. Now an interview that I have really been looking forward to. It's been a long time since I have had a chance to sit down and chat with Heine Snyder. I suppose now that he has a book published and he's an author, I should call him Mr. Garrett Snyder. Is that right?
No, I think Heine is still the Alaskan name.
Good.
Which they gave me when I came to Alaska in 1910. All the Swedes and Norwegians and Germans and Dutch, they're all Heinies.
And which are you?
And I'm a Hollander. Uh-huh. And, of course, Mrs. Snyder is Dutch, and they... Why, it is so used now that if I write Garrett Snyder, they don't
Nobody
know who
knows.
It is. And Mrs. Snyder even calls me Heine, and on payday, she calls me Honey.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, Heine, I think maybe then the place to start is at the very beginning of your story. In what part of Holland were you born?
Well, I was born in Monnikendam. You know, that's not, I'm not saying a bad word, you know. All the dams come from Holland.
Yes.
Uh-huh. In 1886... So I'm 75 years old, and I was the oldest of nine in the family. Very Calvinistic, religious people, brought up proper, and fell by the wayside a few times, but because of my religious training, I'm still a good American citizen.
You took to the sea at what age?
Well, I went to sea when I was a boy of about 16 or 17 years old. And I usually took France leave. You know what that means?
Mm-mm.
Well, it means you sign on and you're supposed to come back on the same ship, see? But if I liked the country, I forgot to go back to a ship and then took in the country.
That's called France leave.
That is France leave, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was, well, good and hungry or needed another ship, well, I signed on a different ship.
Well, what are some of the countries where you decided to stay a while?
Well... That comes later.
I
traveled in Norway and Sweden on a Norske boat, Olaf Kyrre.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to South America and beat it there. And I went way to Cordoba on a freight train and walked back to Rosario and shipped there on an Italian sailing ship, the Esmeralda Bark.
Mm-hmm. 84. This was a ship with sails.
Yeah,
still.
Yeah. Brasa di Maestro, yes. I couldn't understand Italian, but, you know, you walk in there. So, and we had bad weather, and we lost a couple of 2-3 men overboard.
Mm-hmm.
And our destination was Widow, on the Baltic Sea in Russia. And there they had part of a revolution.
Oh.
When I got out of there, we went to Antwerp, and they had a big strike there. So I thought it was time for me to go home and rest up. Then I started on the Dutch West Indian Mail Service. And went to South America. Uruguay and Paraguay, and I got off there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to Holland again and started on the Holland-America line. And finally, on the Uranium Steamship Company, I came to New York. And when I came there, I said, this is really a good place to stay. So I took France leave again, and that kind of later on gave me a little trouble because when you come into New York or to America, you have to make out papers, you know. So I went down to New York, and from New York I traveled with some Salvation Army people to Spokane, Washington. And I worked that winter as a janitor in Paulson's building. And the next spring I took a job as steward on the steamer Dolphin. And there was gold seekers on there. That was in 1910. And so, again, we didn't have to take France leave that time because under Senator La Follette, they had a law in the United States that if a sailor or a fireman signed on a certain town, he could quit wherever he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got in Skagway, I told him, give me my money, and I went with some other stewards down there, and we walked over the pass to Whitehorse, and we built a little boat and pulled it over the ice of Lake Labarge, and then we floated down to Dawson. 7 days it took us. Wonderful trip. Oh, that was a free country.
Were you following the gold trail then?
Yes, and I still got the bug.
Have you ever found any gold?
Well, I found a little bit. I found Mrs. Snyder. That's a gold mine.
You surely did, huh?
Yeah, there's some wonderful things that happens and things, you know, that were so strange to me. If you have time, I'll tell a little story of my experience on the river. Well, we were going downstream, but going upstream was we seen a little boat coming up, see? And when it got closer by, they had to go around our boat at 9 or 10 o'clock. You pull your boat ashore and cook beans. You sit and rowing all day. And this was a native, a Canadian native. And he had his wife and his daughter, I presume they were, pulling the boat, see? And they were wading through their little moccasins, clinging through the waist in the water and over these boulders, you know. And he was sitting in the back of the boat, smoking his little pipe.
That
was not nice. So I says to him, "Hey, you, get out of there and let the woman sit in the boat and you pull it for a while." He says, "Whoa." And the woman stopped and he got out of the boat and I thought he was going to fight me. But he went over to one of my partners and he said, "What's the matter with him, crazy?" Well, I found out he had something there.
Yes, that's a nice life if you can get a woman who'll do it.
Get away with it. Well, that was some of the experience we had in there.
Now, where did you end up? Where were you headed for?
Well, I went to Dawson, and then I got a job on on some of these river boats as a steward, you know. Mm-hmm. And we went from Dawson to, clean to St. Michael's, partly, Holy Cross, mm-hmm. and Nenana, and so, and Fairbanks, up and down the river with these old stern wheelers.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get around to doing any prospecting, though?
Yes, that fall, you know, when the boats froze up, I stayed in, and my partner and I, we went down a place he called Thistle Creek. It's a creek that runs into the Yukon River. And, you sink a hole down to bedrock, you know. You build fires, and the fire burns all night and thaws out the frozen ground. And then you got a wooden bucket, and your partner goes down, and you pull it out, and then you build it again with fire for the next day. So he was an old prospector. He had been prospecting before, but I didn't know anything about it. He says, "Hey, this is bedrock." Well, I didn't know what bedrock was. I says, "What it mean?" Well, he says, "If there's gold, there ought to be some in it." Well, I had big Siva's mitts on. I was 60 and 70 below zero in that country. And I took my mitt off and started scratching in this dirt. And I found something looked like brass, like copper. So I says, "I think I got some gold." Well, I don't want to say what he told me I had. But anyway, I held it. He says, "Well, send it down." I says, "I lose it." Oh, he says, "You spit on it and stick it on the wooden bucket." So I did. Yeah, he says, "It's gold." So he took a wooden bucket, and then in the bucket he sat, and in his hand he had a gold pan with a couple of shovels of dirt. And we went into the cabin, and we had a big washed up with water, and he panned it out, and I could see a little string of gold in there.
Yes.
We had $1.60. We had little scales with penny weights. Well, I couldn't sleep that night. I was going back to the old country. My dad was a shoemaker, and I didn't like it. I was going to throw the shoemaker's table clean through the window and going to give my sister a washing machine. I had given lots and lots of money away. Well, we worked there for a while, but it petered out. The pay streak was only a couple of inches wide. And then later on, I went in the strike in the Shoshana and all over and find something and so on. So finally, there comes a man up the creek one time. It was only my partner and I, and his name was Charlie Snell. He said, "Hello, boys." I said, "Hello." He says, "Do you hear about the war?" I says, "What war?" "Well," he says, "General von Kluck is almost in Paris." "Yeah," he says, "a big war going on." Well, I says to him, "What are we sitting in and waiting for here? Let's go and fight the Kaiser." So I went back to Spokane, where I had an aunt living there, see? And I talked to her about I was going to join the Boyle Companions, the Canadians, and so on. And she says, "Well, you were once in the war before in West Africa when you were in the Foreign Legion." I says, "Yes." Well, she says, "What do you got out of it?" She kept on talking. Finally, she says, "Wait a minute." So she pulled out a letter of a girl by the name of Alice Johanna Aldenburg, who was one of my sweethearts in Rotterdam, an orphan girl. And she says, "Now, here's your chance. Why don't you get married instead of going to war?" And she talked to me so convincingly that I wrote her a letter, and the girl came, and I got married. And if you want to know the truth, the war is still on. That's the biggest war I ever was in.
You brought her over here?
Well, she came over by herself during the submarine warfare.
Oh, my goodness.
And she came to Spokane, but I had to go down. I was then a sergeant of the guards at the San Francisco Fair in 1915. So we went over there. I told the consul general, I says, I have to go to Spokane. He says, for what? I said, well, there's a pretty good-looking girl over there, and all these Dutchmen down there are going to grab her off. I'll have to work fast. He says, good luck. Give you a week. Come back.
How long had it been since you'd seen Alice?
Oh, 5 years, at least, see. So I seen her, and I married her that night. But that's quite a history in itself, you see, because as a rule, I was what they call a hobo over here. I usually was out of money. I had no money. So they called for a minister. We decided to get married, and his minister was walking up and down. And I says to him, I says, what seems the matter with this fellow? Why don't he tie the knot and have it over with? Well, he says, there is a little remuneration. It cost a little money. I says, how much? Oh, he says, $5. I says, you got $5? So I borrowed $5 from her uncle to get married on. I didn't start it very rich.
Yes, you didn't.
But she's been a wonderful partner.
I know that.
Yes, sir.
Well, what happens next?
Well, then I went to Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Did you bring her with you?
I brought her with me, and the first trips that she had, we landed here on the mud flats.
In
Ship Creek. Mm-hmm. And the boats couldn't get up to a dock. So we went down the pilot ladder on the freight. That was the first $2 I made because it costed $2 to be brought over as a passenger, see? She was a passenger, but I was a waiter.
Oh, see? I see.
A steward on the boat. Mm-hmm. And I said goodbye. And the chief steward gave us 2 plates and 2 forks and 2 knives for starting housekeeping.
Well, that's pretty fine.
And we had a little tent I was prepared in a small little bit of a Yukon stove. And we pitched our tent all somewhere. Now there was woods there where the Anchorage Daily News has a newspaper.
Oh,
there was all timber there at that time. Mm-hmm. Then I got a job as an orderly in the hospital. And, I have done everything. So I've even been an undertaker here.
Here in Alaska?
Yeah, right here in Anchorage. Undertaker helper.
Well, don't go skipping now.
Okay. Then we went down there and we lived in a tent down there. And
on C Street.
No, yes, for a while. And then we moved over where now the Alaska Railroad's shops are, way back on there, close to the water. And we lived there for 2 years, and we slept on spruce boughs because there was no mattresses or anything, you know. And we had a little stove, and we had a baby was born. So I made her a cradle out of a sugar barrel and put strings in there so the mattress was laying down. And then we moved up on Government Hill. They had houses built there, and I had something there, an experience which we never forget. We used to have a dock team, see? So I told Mrs. Snyder he was going to expect another baby, and this was the second one, so a woman is not too much careful about it. I says, well, let me know. So by golly, she called me up at 2 o'clock. She says, I think we better go to the hospital. And it was on the 26th of January, and it was just snowing and blowing to beat the bend, you know, and there was nobody was there, and it was quite a ways off. And my dog team had broke loose. I only had one dog left. For some reason, they got loose, and his name was Kaiser. And I put him for the sled, and we started off. I rolled the missus in blankets and started off for the hospital. Well, I had to break the trail every so often, you know, on snowshoes, and then come back and get up. So when we got to the bottom of C Street, the hospital was on the left-hand side there. This was quite a job. And we were all in it. The dog couldn't pull anymore, and I couldn't push anymore. And I says, well, Alice, you sit right here, lay right here, and I'll go and get the doctor or a nurse or somebody. And it was just blowing. It covered all with snow. It was the worst night I've seen. Oh, she says, I can walk. So she started following my tracks, and I kept on going, and I looked back, and I didn't see her. And I looked farther back, but she had fell down. So I picked her up in my arms, and I carried her into the hospital. Well, I kicked on the door, and the nurse, oh, my, she says. I said, well, I think this lady's going to have a, gee, why? And they make quite, see? And she went to Dr. Beeson. She walked over. There was no telephone, no telegraph. And she walked over there, and Dr. Vision came in his pajamas over there. And I stood over the big stove getting the ice out of my nose and so on. And I look at the clock, and it was 6 o'clock. And 15 minutes past 6, Dr. Vision says, "Congratulations, it's a boy." Yeah. And then this boy grew up. I have a story in his book about it. And boy...
By the way, let's say something about the book before we go any farther.
Okay.
This book, just hot off the press. It hasn't even cooled off yet.
No, it's still warm.
So was Alaska. By the way, this was printed right here in Anchorage.
Yes, everything is done by Alaskans. You see, the picture is done by Miss Elizabeth Parks. And all the drawings are by Jane Hafling.
Who took the pictures there are?
These are pictures. They are old pictures from the old country when I was a boy in here.
Right?
Yeah. And some of the little house we lived in, you know, to see how we lived in here. Here is a... And here is when I was a boy. Here I was a steward, chief steward. See, I even wear a mustache there, see? And here I was in South Africa. And here I was in Dawson.
We're getting closer.
Oh, we're getting closer. And here I'm up to the High Grade Gold Mining Corporation. We had a mine up there, and here we're caught in a snowslide, see? And here we're in the mine, and here's a picture of Mrs. Snyder and me when we were the silver wedding up at the mine, 25 years. And here I'm a senator with, Governor Greening, now Senator Greening. And here I was at the Republican convention in Chicago, boosting Eisenhower. And here I'm as a chairman of the mining committee in Juneau, Alaska, in the federal building in the Alaska legislature. And, of course, here are the girls. That's always been my big fault, is all these nice-looking girls around there. And here is a picture of when we were in Holland. And here is a picture of 146 Snyders.
Oh, my goodness.
They're Calvinistic. They have large families. Nobody is a cripple. Nobody has ever been in jail but me. And here I am in the chair of the mayor... The Lord Mayor of Anchorage, the honor seat. And my mother was still alive, and I hadn't seen her for 44 years. And he was there 89 years, and there's the picture of my grandmother. And she's talking to the audience, and I interview her.
Isn't
and three years later, she passed away at the age of 93. And so on, here I am building my new home, see? And that's the fireplace, always gold, silver, molybdenite. And this is the new home, and here I'm inspecting something. Now, you see the new home here, and you want to see the one of the little houses I used to live in here. That was the house we... See? That's something, and here is the old building of the road commission. And there, that is Anchorage, where you see all that timber up there. And that little cross there is the tent when I was orderly in the hospital. And this log house and that log house was a hospital.
And this is the dog team that ran away the night you needed them.
Yeah, and here I got the dog team done. There's two children in there, two of my kids in there.
Isn't this wonderful?
This tar paper and canvas and a little, and we had, we nailed a box on the side, and when it was cold, we put the baby in a blanket. Because when she gets her hand out of there, she freezes her hand. So we put safety pins on a blanket like a straitjacket. And then when they had to nurse her and start crying, I said, "You're ready?" And then we shoved her under the back and we fed her.
Oh, my. Yeah. Honey, when did you go to Wasilla?
Well, that was later on. That was, I don't know exactly the date, but 4 or 5 years later I went to...
Did you homestead up there?
No, I went as a railroad foreman.
Oh.
See, I went over to, first to Matanuska. No, first I was over at Hunter, but I was section foreman at Matanuska in Pittman, Matanuska, and then I resigned by request, if you know what I mean. I had a little argument with the roadmaster, and I hit him over the head with my lunch bucket, and they told me my service was no longer needed. Then I went in the mink business, and I made good money.
You went in the what business?
Mink, raising mink.
Mink?
Oh, yeah. I made very good on raising mink, but mink is a luxury. And if the, if it comes a depression, why people got no money to buy bread, they surely haven't got no money to buy. But before we started in this mink business, when we started, I cut my own wild mink. see? Mm-hmm. And they didn't know nothing about how to raise mink, neither did I. So it has all gone by experience.
You mean the mink didn't know anything about it?
They didn't either.
Heine, I find it difficult to believe that.
By golly.
But you taught them, I suppose.
Well, we got it going, but we couldn't sell any. So we got pretty hard up. It was coffee and crackers, you know. And so I seen one time a track in the snow of a fox. And by the way, it looks he has been in the trap before. There was two toes missing, and I tried everything to catch him. And Mrs. Snyder's birthday is on the 10th of December, and I had set the trap in the snow and had put mink's scent on the tree so that he had to look up instead down. And I said, Mama, I got you a birthday present. But I didn't go out, and it was in 10th of December. Cold, cold. And I went over there, and there was a silver cross fox. And I fell down his leg, and he was all frozen, so I couldn't save him alive. See, I use him for a breeder, so I pelted him. And they sent me $175 for that fur. And we didn't have 10 cents in the house. That was like getting $1 million. The kids got rubber packs, and everybody was happy and wants to eat. So we had done when the mink go on. Well, I made one shipment here. It's right here, and it got $7,000. So we had a little money to dress the kids better. Then they wanted to go to the University of Alaska. I said, I ain't got enough money, but they went anyhow. You know why? They won a scholarship. That's the way to do it.
How many children did you have?
Well, we had four. Three girls and one boy. We had the misfortune of losing him in the war. And we got 13 grandchildren. And we went and visited the only foreigner we have in the family. And that's the great-grandson. He lives in Pensacola.
And all the rest of them are real Alaskans.
All sourdoughs.
Has Alaska been good to you, do you think?
Well, I'm saying so. Because, Ruth, I traveled all over the world, see, for looking for something. And you know what that something was? Freedom. Mm-hmm. And you no place in the world can you find it here. Because now was the biggest population, you know, you'll have to put up a sign, no trespassing. And I hate anchors on the red and green lights while I can't walk on the streets when, you know. Mm-hmm. And that is gone. But we still have freedom. Where is a man like myself now there who was the son of a shoemaker, a poor shoemaker, can become a member of the House and a senator, a grand president of the Grand Lodge of the Pioneers of Alaska, has a nice family, got a beautiful home, can have a garden. You can't get that no place. You get that no place. Yeah.